Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. We are not quite at quorum yet, so I'll give everybody another minute or so to join. While we're waiting, just a quick run through for the agenda. First is that I'm going to talk about Casablanca planning and some of the discussions that we had last week at ONS. Second is multi-CPU architecture. Adolfo is going to present that. And third, Dana is going to talk about API versioning. It appears like we have critical mass, so let me flip over. Can everyone see my screen?
Yep.
Good. Last week at ONS, a small group of us met to talk about the focus of the Casablanca release and how we could work, particularly between the use case and architecture committees, to drive a consistent message for the release. And what we came up with was a focus on deployability, meaning that after the Casablanca release, ONAP would be deployable in multiple operator environments. And we came up with three circles. So it's the technical debt, which is the S3P plus continuous improvement and other things we have to do to the code, plus modularity. And then also 5G fundamentals, which is a little bit fuzzy, but it's along the lines of cloud native, and it's along the lines of enablers for 5G. We know the specs aren't ready yet, and the thing everybody's interested in, slicing, isn't ready yet, but there are some things that we can do to get ready for it in Casablanca. To some extent, this is open for discussion. And then some of the things, you can see the P1 and P2 that we know we need to do. The P1 in the middle of all those circles is microservices. And then the P2s are aligning with standards and then also API standardization and general API improvements, plus BNF and PNF onboarding, and then also containers and external controllers.
Hey, Chris, this is Roger.
Yes.
So with respect to deployability, the OOM team has been working very hard in the Beijing release to make OOM not only deployable, but to do complete lifecycle management of it. Unfortunately, our work seems to be not very well understood by the rest of the community, but we do support the ability to, for example, deploy in an operator's network with different IP addressing schemes, to have custom repos, to be able to configure multiple ONAP instances for different operators with different configurations, or even for developers. So there are upgrade capabilities, there are healing and scaling capabilities, there's load balancing, there's DNS, there's a lot of things that are there now. Mm-hmm. So I think before we go too far into deployability, I would ask that we at least review what's available from the platform today. And you know, the OOM team is welcome, or would certainly be willing to do some demos or webinars or however we think it's best to educate the community on what's already there.
Great, thank you.
I think Chris, if I might add. Yeah. When we say deployability, it was more from the service provider. What would it take for them to start using ONAP? If that's what you meant, then slightly different than what Rosa just described, which we agree and we all educating them would be good. We need a little bit of the service provider to say what would it take for them to start using ONAP in their environment to manage and deploy virtual network elements.
Right.
I think that is the confusion many people have. I think it's not deployability of ONAP itself, how easy it is to deploy. I think it is how to increase the ONAP adoption. Maybe that is what...
Exactly, adoptability versus deploy. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was saying.
It's how can we customize ONAP? How can we make sure that it fits in other environments as well? And this brings in a whole host of things. You see the three circles, but it's also things like federation. Every operator has some unique needs, and how do we make sure that we can get this into their environment? Roger, you have good points, and I welcome you and the OOM team to come and give presentations here. It just goes a little bit beyond what we have today, Vimal was saying.
Yeah, I welcome us going forward. I just wanted to be recognized that ONAP, from a deployability perspective, has gone a long way in Beijing, mm-hmm. and let everyone know about that.
Chris, I think it may be worth explicitly capturing all this as we are double clicking, and I would also like to bring up other point. I mean, essentially, just like the point Roger brought up, right? On the platform side, there is also a big challenge if you walk up to the next layer, right? I mean, just setting up ONAP, and then bringing up something like as simple as a VDNS use case is non-trivial, right? It's completely non-automated,
mm-hmm.
right? I do think that's a big challenge we have to explicitly capture.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in the wiki, we can capture all these challenges, you know, from top down sort of, and then, create an action plan for them.
Sure. And I've got a couple coming up based on our previous discussions, but absolutely, let's, if there are other things, let's bring them up. Let's put them on the table and discuss going into Casablanca. So let me actually just go on. So this is kind of the text version. As I said, we need to make sure that this can go into multiple operator environments. We're not saying that this is production quality necessarily. What we're focusing on is the flexibility to be able to put ONAP into the different environments. And then we also, this is going to be a continuous improvement process similar to what we're doing with S3P. So we're going to make a big chunk and a big focus on deployability in this coming release, but there's probably more to do in Dublin and beyond. Yes, Vimal.
One more comment. So one of the things that we heard from Ala and Majin and other people to say is we want to get input from service provider to really understand what are the key pain points or what they think are the major gaps that they would like to get addressed so that they can start using it.
Yes.
And one concrete example I heard was that, well, we should be able to integrate with OSSB as a system, otherwise it's unusable.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to hear a little bit more, what are the other things that they want to see so that they can start using it?
So we definitely want to tie in with the end user advisory group when this is stood up, and they're in the process of doing that over the next couple of weeks. Some of the things I've been hearing are federation, and then being able to substitute different controllers because some operators already have some that they're working with and they want to make sure that those plug in to ONAP. And then VNF and PNF onboarding and making sure that we have a clean and standardized process for that. And I'll talk a little bit more about that upcoming. We do have a partial list of requirements, and we'll probably get some more over the next couple of weeks, but it's a good point.
A quick question. When you say standards alignment, can we enumerate what standards or what forums you're targeting?
The main thing we're hearing is ETSI, and second is MEF for the Legato and the Interlude interfaces. And there's talk about TMF, but that's more abstract at this point. and others are welcome. We can talk about it. This is just a very high level discussion. We need to, as Ramke said, double click. We need to go deeper and shape how this comes out. But that was the initial thinking.
So in terms of standards, we at the very least need to agree on the final end game for the VNF descriptor and which yes. standards we're going to use. We can't continue to go between multiple standards or to try to combine them together. That's going to be a dead end. So we're looking for something more concrete in terms of the desired end state. So for the VNF suppliers in the virtual room, this is something for you guys to ponder.
Go ahead.
Other thought here, Chris, I think we should explicitly capture the edge cloud support in the architecture priorities. I mean, the rationale is it's a common requirement across several top-level use cases, 5G, then mobile edge computing, and also OSAMP, right? It's worth capturing that explicitly as a priority item.
Well, so I think this fits in with the 5G fundamentals. We'll have to fill out exactly where that is. I'm open to presentations on that. And Ramke, why don't we go back and get that?
Hey, Ramke, the modularity and the external controllers and standardization of APIs, all of those specifics are aimed at support of what you just said. So somehow we just need to generalize, what kind of things we're going to be plugging into ONAP or what ONAP is going to have to interoperate with and define something based on, preferably based on standards for those reference points.
No, I'm completely in line with you, Alex, on that. So the reason, my desire to capture it out more explicitly is between distributed edge clouds and, we have been all in core clouds, right, as you very well know so far.
Yes.
And edge cloud brings out unique requirements. And of course, 5G captures that beautifully, but it's also a common theme across several use cases, right? 5G, then edge computing, and also OSAM. So that was my rationale. This list will definitely capture a lot of those, but essentially make sure, we have a comprehensive capture on that across the board, across all use cases.
It's not a bad idea to capture everything and then reduce it down as opposed to capturing too few things. So maybe.
I'm inclined to think that way. Yeah. And that too, it speaks for alignment to Akraino, right, as we make progress. So that was the angle I was thinking.
Mm-hmm. Ramke, thanks for bringing that up. That's one thing I also wanted to see, how what we need to do for the awesome. That's one of the use case for the edge, right? So like you said, we'll have to I think there will be some overlap between all of the edge use cases. And I'm kind of new to this process, so I appreciate any help here. See what we need to do in terms of specific to awesome, but then like you said, it applies to any of the edge use cases.
Sure. Specific to OSAM, what we would ask you is to come to the architecture meeting and present and just show us how OSAM fits into the architecture, we can help shape that. And then we can go through the priority, and if it comes to new project proposals in a couple of months, then that's going to be one of the prerequisites to go through that process.
Okay. Do you suggest that, this is like a weekly call, right?
Yes.
Do I present on this meeting?
Yes. Talk to me, and I'll get you scheduled.
Okay. Is this Chris? Okay.
Yes.
I just sent an email. You may not have had a chance to look at it. Sorry, I think we missed you last week. But yes, if you could put it on the agenda for next week, you know, we can do that.
Sure.
Hey, Chris, this is Parvi. Yeah. Okay. One thing that is missing, I wasn't in this discussion last week, is the notion of model driven. Where is that captured? It's not CNF, CNF onboard.
No, it's kind of through all of this. That's the expectation. You know, it.
So we kind of had a slightly more generalized set of buckets before they got.
What is in that picture, Alex? Alex, where is the model driven captured in this picture?
In the intersection between the circles.
Yes, so it would be part of P1 and part of microservices.
Okay, microservices is different from model driven.
You're absolutely right. We need to add that in.
Yeah.
Could you make a note, Chris, because that's very important, okay? So the data modeling aspects is captured kind of partially, but the model driven. Yes. And then we are talking about technical depth and then dimension. This is vague. What that really means, we need to elaborate on that, okay? That's my second comment.
Well, that's the continuous improvement. That's the stuff that we already know that we need to do with the existing code.
So actually, we had two buckets. There was continuous improvement and things we know we can't live without. Mm-hmm. And so things we know we can't live without would have model-driven some of the other things, but then they would kind of fall into multiple buckets. That's why they're in the intersection, right?
So, Chris, instead of dimension, could you just say what you said? Because dimension means nothing to me. Okay, then the yellow circle, it says 5G fundamental. In the deployability, it doesn't mean fundamental. The 5G is a use case. It's a technology. Could someone elaborate on that? You mean network slicing?
That's what I was mentioning. The 5G specs aren't ready, but we thought that we couldn't go another release without talking about 5G, so we're going to do some of the enablers, which are... you know, similar to cloud native in terms of what we can do getting ready for 5G in this release
what we said was that for 5G we did something in Beijing to support a physical network element like DUs. It wasn't complete, so we want to complete that. Also deploy some of the virtualized network element at the edge. That's what Ramki was saying, that has the edge dependency. So can we deploy 5G network elements, whether it's a RAN element or core element? And slicing might be something that I don't think will be. We might show a demonstration of simple slice, but I don't think slice specifications are clear, and people have different view of slices.
Okay, Vimal, hold on. Vimal, could you please add a few bullet items, maybe in a separate page, to explain what 5G fundamentals mean?
Sure. I'll do that.
That really helps.
So we can capture what we have in 5G use case and just say what is the focus in Casablanca. I'll send one slide to.
So guys, don't forget that, you know, these are not the only things, right? This is a very, very rough high level view. Each one of these three circles has features and capabilities of ONAP. And then what we really need to do is look at the intersections and see what kind of requirements are needed to support them. Right, so that's the whole idea of using a Venn diagram.
That's okay. Alex, we are not against this. We need to clarity, and this is the time, I guess. Chris, that's your point. You want to bring clarity
between now and the start of the Casablanca planning at end of May. We need to go from these circles to something actionable.
Vimal for 5G and technical depth is Alex. We are missing model driven aspects and technical depth is SJP.
So one thing,
and also looking at this picture carefully, sorry for jumping in, so it looks like we have to capture cloud native explicitly. because that's a key message you want to drive, right? This doesn't seem to be capturing that essence of it, and that would become a P1. And cloud native, then there are two categories, right? Cloud native ONAP components and cloud native network functions. So then automatically that would...
So hang on, we're not developing VNFs. So we need to be careful here because this is all about ONAP as a platform. So the fact that we need to enable support or deployment of cloud native VNFs is another requirement altogether. The fact that ONAP itself needs to be more coherently organized into a set of microservices based on a cloud native pattern, that's what we're here to. That's what that requirement means. Very big difference.
Yeah, and
no, absolutely. But what I'm saying is, we have to clarify and capture those,
sure,
right? If we look at the term containers, then it kind of signals both to me in my mind. Of course, the first thing that comes to my mind is ONAP components. Then, since I've been discussing the other VNF containerization, so it's good to be a little more explicit about it. That's what I meant. Cloud native and those.
Sure.
Right.
And Chris, hold on, Chris. The P2. Why P2 is outside the 5G circle? Why?
Yeah. No, it's the intersection. P1 is the intersection of all three, and P2 is the intersection of two.
P2. No, P2 doesn't include 5G. Why not?
What do you mean?
There are three P2s. P2s.
Of them are in 5G.
Oh, right. Sorry. There are three P2s. Okay. My bad. Okay.
Parviz. Okay. Good morning, yeah. Parviz.
I was looking. Okay. Okay, Alex. Please go on.
No, just one comment. Deployability, Parviz, is actually implies that we need to look at the deployment scenarios for 5G environments and what they mean in terms of manageability, in terms of regional behavior and multi opco behavior and whatnot. So the things that we kind of touched on in Los Angeles, in terms of how do we actually create a management plan to support all this, that's the idea here, right? How do we make things actually deployable and manageable?
Okay. And Chris, you have someone sign up for external controller. I guess Alex made a presentation in this past or something.
Yeah, I'm gonna resurrect it, and let's see what we can do now that we actually have something officially on the books.
Okay.
Talking about external controllers or external orchestrators, which is probably a recursive orchestration topic?
Both.
Okay. And then I have a couple of comments on this diagram. Based on the discussion I heard so far, the yellow circle should be not 5G fundamentals, but 5G enablers.
Yes.
At least that's what has been discussed so far. And then the question from Parviz about the top P2, why is it outside of 5G fundamentals or enablers? There is an item that talks about standards alignment, and then alignment with 5G standards. It should not be outside of 5G enablers.
Yeah,
support for 5G models that have been defined elsewhere. That's an important topic, I would say, because we need to distinguish the standard alignment with ETSI, which is probably P2, and it could live up there. But if you want to manage 5G, you need to be able to work with 5G models, and it's slightly different.
Well, 5G is just one of the use cases we're looking to enable, so that's another discussion, right? How much does ONAP actually do in that regard?
See, the whole point is that if you want to show 5G enablers here, right, that means that you want to be able to manage a 5G defined VNF and PNF. And they are modeled elsewhere, and the models do exist for them, right? So basically, if you want to deal with those models, that should be inside the 5G circle.
Okay, probably, I see what you mean.
Mm-hmm. Probably the standard alignment need to be explained, not just generic standard alignment on the P2 on top, but be more explicit. And there could be alignment inside the 5G circle as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So why don't we go on. So we've already talked about a number of priorities that I think we've been talking through here. I think it lines up. Here's my take. We had the priority list from a couple weeks ago, and I tried to map it into the circles. And I tried to prioritize it based on what I could see for what fit in the P1, P2, and P3. Some of these, we need to do it. I wasn't sure exactly where to put it for now, so I just left them at the bottom. But that's open for discussion, and that's where we can reslot them into you know, some of the other pieces. And what I wanted to show is at least 12 out of the 17 already fit in the strong priorities. So I think we already have some initial alignment, but this is where we'll want to get to that next level of detail.
Sorry, P3, what's P3 in the previous diagram? The rest?
The rest. It's the stuff that goes into the main circles, but not the overlap.
Thanks.
Sure. So next steps, as I said, we're scheduling topics for upcoming calls. I've got this week and most of next week tied up, but it's open after that. So let me know if or when you want to present. We need to get a draft architecture by M0, have it frozen by M1, and fully approved by M2. Between M1 and M2, what we're really doing is adding new projects that come in. We'll need to have discussion and approval during the Beijing face-to-face, which is June 19th, possibly some updating depending on the new project proposals. It's a big lift from where we are now to where we're going. I talked to a number of you at ONS last week, and we all just agreed that there's a lot of value to a face-to-face meeting where everybody can sit down and then even go off in the corner and do some work. And I wanted to check whether we want to do a face-to-face meeting to finalize this near the end of May. One good event, I want to try to minimize everybody's travel budgets. And one event where I think a number of us are already going is OpenStack, which is the week of May 21st in Vancouver. We could either have a meeting at the venue or elsewhere in Vancouver during that week, if that works for people. And if you have other thoughts, let's raise those as well.
When is Memorial Day, Chris?
I think it's the week after that. I think it would be the 28th.
Okay, so we may want to do this closer to the beginning of this week because people will be taking days off with kids and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, we can just...
One thought on Vancouver, would it be possible to keep this separate from the OpenStack Summit path? If you're sort of coming for a day, then would we absolutely need the pass, or it's like we come and have this meeting in a separate room? I'm trying to loosely couple it with the OpenStack Summit if possible.
Yeah. I have a question into OpenStack about, can we work with them? But we can also, grab a room at one of the hotels nearby. So that way, if people are already attending, they can go to OpenStack, but we can have our meeting for a day.
So would it be possible to do something in Seattle instead? And it's just a jet foil ride away, 1 hour. But at least this way we can maybe use Huawei facilities where nobody charges us $1,500 a pop or whatever it is.
It would be a possibility. Is that more convenient to people? Then you'd have to fly. I mean, yes, it's a short flight, but then you'd have to put in an extra trip.
You can drive. Seattle is it's drivable from Vancouver.
Yes.
It's a 3-hour drive or it's a half-hour flight, but then you have to deal with the airport.
Right, but then you you're distributing the cost, and it's going to be like 10 times as more expensive if you calculate it that way.
Yeah.
Well, if you take the jet foil from Seattle to Vancouver, it's not long, and you can do it as a day trip. I don't know how many days we would have the offsite for.
I was thinking we'd do a whole day meeting, since there is other stuff going on that week. But if we could sequester ourselves for a day, I think we'd be able to make a lot of progress on this.
Okay. I'm just thinking, how do we avoid paying money for OpenStack? That's kind of
Well, but what we could do is grab a hotel meeting room at one of the other hotels if we needed to do that. Yeah.
And this is in addition this is in addition to or instead of the June ONAP Developer Summit?
This would be in addition to. This would just be for architecture. It would be a one-day or so meeting to do a deep dive and finalize the architecture so that when we go into the June meeting, essentially we're looking for approval and not for discussion.
Chris, would it be earlier in the week or later in that week?
We can adjust. The only thing that I can't give up is I'm speaking on that Thursday. So it won't be Thursday, but we can pick a day other than that.
No, I have personal commitments here early in the week. So I can't leave before Monday, maybe Tuesday.
Okay.
So I leave Tuesday. But maybe that's just my problem. We'll see.
Okay. Other thoughts?
Any chance to make it on the Sunday, just the day before the OpenStack?
Well, it sounds like Steve would be tied up and some other people. We can certainly talk about that. I can send out a doodle poll for that week, and we can see what days work best for other people. Conceptually, people are okay with this, and then we can work out the logistics in the next, let's say, 2 weeks. Does that work?
Yep. Doodle poll is perfect.
Okay.
We can also, Chris, probably suggest some locations, I think, and also try to avoid the OpenStack Summit cost. Then we can do things.
Great. If any of our Canadian colleagues have a meeting room in Vancouver, would they be willing to donate? That would be wonderful as well. Let's keep talking about this. Let's try to finalize in about 2 weeks.
Quick question, but where is the June meeting?
It's in Beijing.
Beijing? Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Let me turn this over next to Adolfo.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Sure.
So let me start my presentation here. And my goal is to introduce the concept of platform agnostic ONAP. And my objective is at the end of this discussion is to connect this idea of having a platform agnostic ONAP with the discussion we're having about deployability. So let me get going with this. Jump in at any time if you have questions, but if you also want to wait till the end for the discussion, that's also a good way to go. So let me start by offering some data points to set the context for what this means. Back in October, we started running some experiments using in this particular case, ARM, which is the hardware we had in our hands. And we tried to install ONAP on an ARM server, and it failed. We got a Go error. This is not a GUT error, but rather a Go error. That's because the Docker engine is written in Go. So when you get the exit format error, that's a clear indication that you're dealing with an incompatible CPU architecture. So the MSB container back from October 2017 could not run on an architecture different than Intel. It could only run on an Intel. We kept going and ran another experiment in 2017 in December. This is not something we run. This is something that has been documented on the wiki page. Same problem. In this case, was installing BrainShare, which is one of the key components for ONAP. And we had the same problem in February, a couple of months ago. So we're still confronting this problem of not being able to run containers in an ARM-specific architecture. What does that mean? What are the implications for ONAP? The obvious one that hopefully you will agree with me is that ONAP is not platform agnostic yet. And I emphasize yet. We work into it. There's many aspects that are changing, that we're evolving. The other implication is that, of course, ONAP is not vendor agnostic. And that has also an effect on what we were talking about, which is deployability. So if we go back to the ONAP principles that have been discussed, and you have to keep in mind that's also an ongoing conversation. There are different versions, and if you talk to different people, they have a different view of what the main architectural principles are. But I think there's a few of them that we all agree upon. Number one, and this we were just discussing this a minute ago, right? The idea that we have to provide cloud environment support for the platform, right, in particular. The idea that the ONAP has to be vendor and service agnostic, that it has to be microservices-based, which is at the center of all these circles we were looking at, P1, microservices-based. I don't think there's any discussion about that. But also from an implementation perspective, one of the principles that have been stated is that it has to provide CI/CD support. So let me focus for a moment on the cloud environment support, which we've been discussing about. And what we're saying there is that all ONAP components must provide support for virtual machines and containers. And I emphasize containers because what I'm going to say next relates to containers. But in general, all components should be software-based, no question about that. And there should not be a requirement on a specific hardware platform. So that's a fundamental principle that has been stated about what the characteristics or the requirements for the platform. So is there a solution? There is a solution, as I said. I'm going to focus specifically on the container use case. There's a solution that came to life in September 2017. In September 2017, Docker released what is called the multi-architecture support for base images. So if you went to Docker Hub today, you will find images that can support multiple architecture, multiple platforms. And the way they do it is by using what is called the FAT manifest, which I'm showing you here just for illustration purposes. If you have questions, we can have a discussion later. But basically the FAT manifest is a way for a container to pretty much support multiple CPU architectures. And they do that by focusing on the concept of a platform. A platform in the context of containers has three components or three vectors, the OS, the CPU architecture, and in some cases, the CPU architecture variant. You could potentially run ONAP on Windows today. I haven't tried it, but maybe you could. So far, the concept of multi-platform that we have been using, it stays at the level of the OS. What Docker has recognized is that you have to go a little bit deeper and look at the CPU architecture. That's what the FAT manifest allows us to do, create CPU agnostic Docker containers or platform agnostic Docker images. Why is that important? Well, that's important because in the past, if you wanted to use a image or a container in different CPU architectures, you basically have to create different containers and label them in a very specific way, normally making a reference to the architecture. It was a pain, right? So now with the FAT manifest, a container can represent multiple platform specific images. And most importantly, they can all be referenced by a single name. on the surface, they could be, this could seem like a minor issue, but when you are developing for multiple architectures and you need to keep track of multiple images, this is a nightmare. So this is a great step in the right direction, and it will make the life of the developers much, much simpler. What that enables is for OnApp developers to use official images. And it turns out that those official images are available for several platforms and architectures. There is a gap that we need to cover. Many projects use base images that are stored in our own OnApp repository. And some of them may not have been synced up with the new versions of the official images that Docker has released. So there's a little work that needs to be done there, but it's not insurmountable. At the end of the day, what this enables us to do is for OnApp projects to build and package images that can be executed on different runtimes, on different platforms, on different OS, which is in a way a contribution to the concept of deployability that we have been discussing this morning. So if we were to do this, if we were to start packaging Docker images for OnApp components that can run on multiple platforms, what would we have to do? What would be the ideal condition or conditions? Number one, we will need to have official images, Docker official images that can support multiple architectures. Number two, the OnApp Docker registry must be able to store multi-architecture images, right? Number three, we should be able to build and package multi-architecture images in a way that is minimally disruptive to projects, right? We all have a lot to do. Folks in the projects are extremely busy. We don't want to interrupt the flow of work. We don't want to disrupt the progress. There are some other timelines and constraints that we have to deal with. So we want to make this happen in a non-disruptive way. And fourth, you will need a space where you can actually make this happen. So development servers and a particular build pipeline where different CPU architecture builds can take place. So let's look at these conditions. Have those conditions been met? Number one, yes. We already have multi-architecture support images. Number two, last time I checked, I think this is the case, our Docker registry supports V2. Yeah, the FAT manifest, so we could store multi-architecture CPU images. Number three, we can make this happen by just introducing incremental changes to the build of the different containers. And I'll talk a little bit on why that is can be simple. And number four, we bring into the community as a contribution access to servers, and we could help set up a build pipeline. So in a way, all these conditions could be met starting today, and we could decide if we want to adopt this approach. So what would a multi-CPU architecture build pipeline look like? What I'm showing here is an example. I think the key point is I'm using Maven here for illustration purposes, but it could be anything. It could be a build pipeline for Java. It could be a build pipeline for Python. Yeah, whatever we're using, right? So what is the fundamental concept? The fundamental concept is that at the end of the day, what we want to do is to produce containers that can be run on any architecture. I'm offering here two possible examples. I'm offering an ARM and an Intel architecture, but we can have more pipelines if we, for instance, want to bring some other CPU architecture. And the other key concept is everything starts from a single source of truth, which is the source code. We just set up a very simple architecture pipeline, produce the binaries that are needed for this specific CPU architecture. And then here's the interesting concept, right? And here's where some changes may need to happen, but they tend to be very minor. And what you do is that you just have a Docker file for each one of the different pipelines, right? And what they produce is not a complete new Docker image. All they produce is just another layer in a single image. And that's the key aspect, right? It has the production of multi-architecture images has become so easy that all we have to do is think of each pipeline is just producing another layer that the fat manifest in the Docker container can simply incorporate and create the right image for the right GPU architecture. The other aspect that is important is that the official images are now multi-architectures. There's not a lot of work that needs to be done except to sync up our repositories with perhaps Docker Hub. And at the end of the day, we will have a multi-architecture version of the containers. So is it possible? Well, we have been working on this for a while, just to validate that this is feasible. So we now have availability of hardware and human resources to support the changes. We have been discussing this with a few teams. We got validation, at least verbally, and we discussed the approach with the folks, some folks from the integration team. There is an ongoing collaboration with members of the OON team. I'm not suggesting that there's endorsements. All I know is they are aware of it, and they have been providing support, and they're working with, particular with ARM servers in the context of the OPNFV auto project. Also, within the folks from the OOF team are open, at least initially open, to work on producing multi-architecture containers. OOF being a fairly new project, I think, offers a lot of opportunities to make this happen in a very simple way. And also, we're in dialogue with the Linux Foundation to provide the infrastructure that could support another build pipeline. So a couple of examples here. I won't go into a lot of details, but here's a few of the servers that are available that could be accessed by developers, as I'm basically starting today. But at the end of the day, the key is, how do we simplify adoption? How do we make this happen without disrupting the normal flow of work? And so here's a couple of things we could do. Number one, set up a multi-CPU architectural build pipeline using, in this particular case, ARM hardware as a test bed. That's what we're willing to contribute. And incrementally and iteratively add projects to the to the CPU, multi-CPU pipeline. As I said, there's a couple of projects that have expressed interest and willingness to start experimenting with this. Our expectation is that the changes are minimal and they won't be disruptive. So what is the call to action? Number one, in a way, this is part of what we were discussing a few minutes ago, right? So we want to add multi-CPU architecture support as a requirement for the Casablanca architecture. Number two, ask teams around projects to use, build, and package images that can be executed on various platforms and architectures. In many cases, the first step that we need to take here is fairly simple, which is to make sure projects are using the latest versions of the Docker official images. So that's not required a lot of work. However, that is fundamental to the idea of supporting cloud environment. Right? Now, all this, if you look at it, supports the discussions we've been having, right, of enabling on-app portability, which in turn is an aspect, it's a dimension of deployability. So, and you will ask yourself, okay, how does all this connect to the discussion we're having? So if you think about the image, the Venn diagram we have been discussing, P1 is at the center of what I'm talking about here, right? The idea of using microservices. P2, it again connects directly with what we're saying here because we're producing containers. The idea of reducing technical debt, you know, the longer we wait to make these changes, the more difficult it is and the most expensive it is to actually make it happen. So the sooner we act on this, the faster we will reduce our technical debt. Not to mention the fact that we want to support cloud native components. So Chris, if we were to look at the priorities page that you mentioned before, where you are mapping the different items to the circles, mm-hmm. I will argue that this proposal maps to P1, P2, technical debt, and enable P3, which is the modularity concept that you were discussing. Mm-hmm. So that's what I have to share for the day, and this is the call to action for this team.
So, what's the minimal viable product then? It's getting IT to put in the second build pipeline, and it's getting one project to sign up so that we can validate the approach all the way through. Is that right? Or do we need more?
That's right, Chris. And the minimum viable product is an ONAP-specific multi-CPU architecture container that we can run on multiple architectures.
So a clarification question here. So certainly, I mean, between ARM and Intel, the application images are different, right? So if you're starting that way, then automatically then the Docker files need to be different, and it's all about building a pipeline. The point that is not clear to me is that you were talking about the merging of the Docker files. That's the part which is not quite clear to me, what value that is bringing. And fully understand the two build pipeline.
No, there is no need to merge the Docker files. You do need, in some cases, if there's no unofficial image, you may need to point to the specific base image that supports a different architecture. But in principle, okay, the Docker file could be the same. We're just putting here the worst case scenario.
Okay.
So this could be decoupled.
Hold on, Vimos first and then Alex.
Yeah, so this could be decoupled from a release in the following sense. We could take Amsterdam or Beijing release and yep, say, can I support multi-CPU without impacting anybody else? This integration, creating the right images and testing it. And that gives you a least impact on the regular project. They don't have to keep testing all the time. So this could be after the release is completed in the beginning and tested that it can support multi-CPU, and then over time, we can make it an integral part of the release.
That is an option. I would not recommend it, because you may find at the end of the release that you have some very specific environment setups or very specific settings that could impact the generation of the binary. The risk is minimal, Vimal, but we cannot say that the risk is zero.
Yeah. Okay. Otherwise, I think that we increase the testing time and integration time, so that might have an impact on the time schedule, but that's something about country.
We could schedule it differently with integration, that we have one of the images that's the primary vehicle, and the other one we kind of do spot checks on. let me turn this over to Alex next.
Just wanted to get, so this is a good presentation, Adolfo. Just wanted to clarify a couple of things. You mentioned the MSB is one example that cannot run on ARM. Do we know why that is?
Yeah, at the moment, it's because it could only support, they were using a base image that only supported Intel architecture.
So it's not any dependency on any particular hardware feature or anything like that?
Actually, it's a dependency of a hardware feature. It depends on SSA 4.1 and 4.2. This is why it's not able to start, not even on older Intel hardwares.
So I think this brings up my second point, and I think you will agree with this, Adolfo. There will be features on hardware platforms from different hardware platform vendors that may somehow advantage and accelerate the execution of ONAP, or, you know, do something, you know, to kind of improve its overall performance.
The current state is not a performance tweak, it's more like a bug.
Understood, but I'm going to use this as an example, right? We should probably say, as one of your requirements, should probably state that we should not preclude platform-specific acceleration features from being consumed with an ONAP, otherwise you're restricting us to the least common denominator model. which may or may not be okay. So I'm not saying that we need to bake in all sorts of vendor-specific things like this is only, you know, this is, you know, specific to ARM or AMD or Intel, but what I'm saying is the inverse. If there is a way to configure ONAP on a particular platform to take advantage of the HPA-specific features during execution, we should be able to do that.
Yeah, I don't think that's the problem. The whole idea is to guarantee that without a lot of effort, we can make ONAP deployable on different environments.
Sure.
The same page.
Okay.
Hey, Adolfo, this is Harvey's.
Uh-huh.
Adolfo, could you check the window, the chat window? I believe that you're following the same logic in what I put in the chat window, or it's different? You can either run this on a Docker repository and blah, blah.
Okay. Can you say a little bit more? What?
Like chat window, it shows that this is a known problem, yeah? It's not only for ONAP. So you can, it says you can either run this from a Docker repository, build your own containers based off the base image, or use a pre-packed image that runs on multiple architectures. Are you proposing the same, or your proposal is different?
Okay, I'm reading what you put here. It says, Docker containers by default contain binaries for Intel systems. That is not an accurate statement, starting on September 2017. Why? Because September 2017, Docker adopted a multi-architecture CPU, or multi-CPU architecture containers, supported by the FAT manifest. It was true before September.
Okay. So this is obsolete now.
Correct.
All right. I'll take your word for it. I'm not an expert.
Okay. I experienced a lot of pain, so I speak from pain.
Okay. So what I'm hearing from the committee, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm hearing interest in this. And I'm hearing that we should approach the LFIT and say that from the architecture committee, we think that multi-architecture should be supported. Did I get that correct? Because I think that's the key enabler here.
Definitely, yes, but also we need to make sure that the pain on the individual projects is minimized. The point Vimal brought up, I think, is important, sort of how we at least go about it, right? Should be that maybe a simple starting point could be just the integration team.
And the impact on the timeline. So if
exactly.
Right. We have to, I think, come up with the minimum viable product. Just like with the number of the other features we introduced in Beijing, it's a couple of PTLs who say that they're willing, and then we can kind of work out the bugs with the process with that team or teams, and then be able to roll it out to the rest of the components following that.
Agree.
Okay. Chris, this is Parviz. I wonder if this is an ONAP problem. This is an industry problem, correct?
Yes, but we're not going to be able to solve everything. If we focus starting here, I think we can make some significant progress.
Certainly an industry problem, Parviz, but also there is an ONAP role also, right? So, for example, definitely if you walk into Kubernetes, they support the ARM platform. Of course, they always, when they find bugs, they resolve, but then we are a consumer of Kubernetes, right, and building applications. So there is a delta on top of it we need to bring to the table, right? Correct, the application part, correct.
Well, okay, here is my take from an architecture perspective. If the hardware architecture, CPU architecture, is driving a new requirement for ONAP, so be it. So we need to address that. If that problem is already an existing problem, as Adolfo says, September 2017, so there is a fix that based on the Adolfo's proposal, correct? Is there an industry-wide fix for that or no?
Well, it's along the lines of what Adolfo said. From our perspective, what we need to do is enable the second build pipeline through LFIT. So they've got to get some ARM servers turned on, ARM servers turned on and in the pipeline. And then we need to have the projects update a couple of the POM files to make, when they do their build jobs, that it uses that second pipeline as well as the first. So when it goes to Jenkins, instead of having one job kickoff, it'll kick off two. And then there will be two sets of binaries, two Docker containers, and then integration at least periodically has to test with the second one. So mostly it affects the POM files for the affected projects, unless there are specific features.
And here's the other thing, that the pattern of changes is the same for all projects. So if we discover and debug how to make it for one project, replicating that should be very simple because you're looking at the exact same pattern.
Okay, Chris, I guess you summed it up, yeah?
Yeah. Any other thoughts or comments from the team?
Before closing on this, just curious, one question pops to my mind. How do you normalize, for example, CPU, number of virtual CPUs across Intel and ARM-based platforms? Are there any standards for doing that across different, generations of Intel versus ARM? Or is it like just you have to go through the testing and figure it out ourselves?
So the good news there is from the perspective of a container, there's no concept of CPU. That's at the virtual machine level.
No, so to be specific, Adolfo, as we know, we can actually specify the number of CPUs and number of memory for containers, right? As we progress, it's one of the key AIs, as part of OM. Working on, right? I mean, as we go to next level, right? Basically, we want to do fine-grained QoS, which is a critical feature as we progress to large-scale deployment. So
correct.
Definitely, there will be a CPU awareness, resource awareness, in short summary.
Right. Correct. Now, when you build a Docker container, there's no indication of what hardware is going to be running. That's the beauty of containers, right? A complete isolation from the hardware level. If I understand what you're saying, Ramki, correct me if I'm wrong, you're referring to the concept of deploying and the orchestration of the containers themselves, where I think you're right. But what we're proposing here is to create building blocks, which are the multi-CPU architecture containers that could be orchestrated by let's say Kubernetes or any other orchestration solution that could take into account that. So the containers are agnostic and it can be orchestrated in any scenario with any resource allocation schema.
That is absolutely correct, Adolfo. All I'm saying is this is a component we need to be cognizant of. I mean, if you're running them as like, say in a simple terminology, like best effort containers where we're not really specifying any CPU or memory, beautiful, all done, right? But if you're trying to get to the next level of resource specification, we need to be cognizant of, especially as we get to testing, how it's going to work out, right? Across an Intel server versus ARM server, right? How do we normalize those? That's all I'm saying.
Right? Yeah, no, agree. And just to be clear with the community here, the way we want to approach this is by running experiments, collecting data, and iterating to optimize the solution in a way that there's no disruption. Not only disruption in development, disruption in deployment, disruption in testing. So we're very mindful of what this means and it should not be disruptive at any level. But I agree with you, Ramki. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, thanks.
Great, any final thoughts before we close on this? Okay, thank you, Adolfo.
Sure.
And next up is Dana with API versioning.
Thanks, Chris. Let me get my deck up. Okay. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. As Chris said, my name is Dana, Dana Bobko. Today I'm going to talk about common versioning strategy for APIs. It's worth a mention that I am also working with Greg Glover to combine what his efforts are on the documentation side, because there's intersection points between his effort and my effort. So at a high level, what we're trying to accomplish with this common versioning strategy is to implement semantic versioning, so major minor patch for APIs, implement a predefined set of custom headers to communicate the minor patch and latest version, align the URLs to only include the major version so that this way you know from the headers you can tell the minor patch and latest, but the major would reside in the URLs, adopt a backwards compatibility policy for APIs that's current major release minus 1 year, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. And that's adjustable, of course. And then, if necessary, refactor the APIs to support the concept of minor releases, and then documentation using Swagger with the guidance that is provided in this deck. So some of the goals is to of the CVS is to standardize the API versioning, get a backwards compatibility policy, and then expedite the development and testing of the API. So we want to get APIs speaking the same language in terms of how the versions are characterized, and also that they can be released as minor versions instead of a major release each time, which introduces breaking changes, right? And that'll kind of expedite the testing and minimize development introducing those breaking changes. With the backwards compatibility policy, then it puts a limit or a time frame on how long the previous versions need to be active and available so that the clients have time to adapt. And then the API clients, when we do introduce another major release or even a several sets of minor releases, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, we can target those specific versions so that, perhaps a client, a new field was introduced and they're not interested in it and they just want to stay on the old version. So that minimizes the impacts to them. And they can kind of, the APIs can continue to evolve without breaking any of the clients. And then lay the foundation for some of the API cataloging, consistent Swagger documentation, and then eventually automate the compatibility dependency matrices. So the semantic versioning, same standard language that semver.org uses, major when you make an incompatible change, minor when you add functionality that's backwards compatible, and the patcher / build position when you make invisible changes such as bug fixes. So it's the same definition that's being used at the component level today in ONAP. So standardizing the URLs to put a structure in where it's the root, the service, / API name, B, the version number, and then the resource path. So when we talk about service or API name, that's a grouping of resources. So just to kind of put it into context for everyone. So if you have, a specific API that has several different resources, we group those together, as the major release off of that API. And then also, the service or API name is not the resource. It's intended to group the related resources. So backwards compatibility policy, like I said, was major release as the current release minus 1 year. So in other words, if you have the first major, which is 1.0, then you introduce 1.1 and then you introduce 1.x, that number could be, infinite. It could be 25, whatever. Once 2.0 is released, then that means that 1.5, which is compatible all the way back to 1.0, would stay in the production environment period of 1 year to give the opportunity for the clients to adapt. So, and one of the requirements of this is that the API owners will ensure that no end-to-end services break with the deprecation of an API due to the backwards compatibility policy. And that backward compatibility policy, like I said, I'm proposing 1 year, but it might have to be a little bit longer for ONAP. I know eBay has the same idea, it's 1 year, but for ONAP with how many releases that are done a year, it might be required that gets extended, but that's not written into the code anywhere. That's just a policy.
Isn't the number of years we support something going to be dependent on government regulation and industry regulation as well?
So can you kind of repeat that? Because I didn't quite understand.
Can the actual range or the duration of time we support something, isn't that really operator, industry, and government specific?
Well, I guess you would tie it into that. That's why I said that's something that's flexible. Like the policy in this proposal, nowhere is the BWC set as something that's within the code so that, like, you know, that date comes and then the API, deprecates. It's nothing like that. It's more of a policy thing that the architecture committee is going to have to take those things into consideration to figure out, you know, how long do you want to do it? Do you want to do it 12 months, 18 months, 2 years? We know that it can't exist forever, right? So you can only support it for so long. That's not very cost effective, right? So I would leave that to the architecture committee to decide, you know, what that BWC timeframe should actually be. Did I kind of answer your question, or?
Sure, it gives me a sense of where you're going. That's fine.
I'm sorry, that was a little muffled.
Alex, we lost you.
Yeah.
Sorry, it gives me a sense of where we're going. So.
So, any other questions about that? No? Okay. So I talked about the custom headers and behaviors, and I should note, you know, there's so many different ways that you can kind of version APIs and communicate the version back and forth. This is just one proposal, and, you know, the architecture committee can decide if this works or if they want to use, you know, other means to communicate those versions. But basically, there's a minor version, patch version, and latest version. The major version is going to be up in the URL, so you'll know which major version it is. But we don't want the clients to break as we onboard with this, so it will fall back instead of fall forward. So the minor version is optional for the client. And in the instance that a client does not provide that minor version, then the server will return the last major version so that nothing breaks. And then the client should ignore any additional values in the payload in the response if provided. So if they call like a major they call their version and there's something that's introduced and they fall back, if there's additional content in there, we don't want anything to break. So they should only be looking for what is in their interface agreement for that version of whichever specific API. And then of course, you know, the optional for the client sends the minor, and then the server returns back the minor patch and the latest version. And the reason why the latest version is included is because we want to make sure that the client is aware that, hey, there's a later version than what you've been requesting. So it's just kind of a notification. It puts a little bit extra on the server, but I mean, it's worth it in the long run. So that this way, if the client's missed something, they know that, hey, there's a later version that we might want to use. And then I have like a slide that goes through, you know, very specifically, you know, what these headers do. And I'm not going to walk through every line of this. I'll make sure that Chris, I can get with Chris and put it up so that folks can see. But, you know, some rules around it as far as, you know, it's a single version, you know, where it's optional, where it's mandatory. And then also, you know, what you should use the patch version for. That's basically for troubleshooting, just in case, you know, a server introduced a change and they said, oh, this is backwards compatible, but really, you know, the client gets it and it breaks. Then the client at least knows, hey, by the way, you know, something happened here where the patch is a little bit different. So maybe they did introduce a breaking change and just didn't know it. And then I have some flows that go back and forth, like, you know, little use cases as far as, you know, what the payload would be and how this would work, what it would look like with the server sending it, if the client doesn't specify it or if they do specify it, so that it kind of keeps everything in alignment. And it's continued with the use cases. So the evolution over time, you know, as that API version or the API evolves version wise, then at least we know, you know, kind of, you know, how, what the behavior should look like for these custom headers. So I want to talk about Swagger a little bit. I know we're already using Swagger, and there's, you know, the intent to roll on to the OpenAPI 3.0 on the roadmap. But we want to make sure that we set some guidance around what's in the Swagger so we can use that to kind of drive some cataloging efforts and whatnot. And in this last slide that I have talks about specifically which, you know, there's some optional things in Swagger, but we want to kind of make them required so that we can, you know, get version out of it. And this is really where like my efforts intersect with Greg's efforts. So again, I'm not going to read through everything in the slide. I'll make sure that folks get a copy of the deck so they can take a look at it. But, you know, there's a couple to just point out, like in the info object, we want, you know, these are required anyway, title, description, version. But that version is the version number of the Swagger file, not necessarily the version of the API. So then we have some interface under the path. We want to have interface info, you know, with API version with the fully qualified version number, and then some other things like the retirement date, you know, so that clients know, hey, you know, when they're looking at the Swagger output, you know, it that this API has an intended retirement date. However, like I said, we don't want to break anything just based on the backwards compatibility, the VWC policy. So APIs might be active after the retirement date, but they're not guaranteed to remain in production. So, and we should be able to push that retirement date out to accommodate the backwards compatibility for the clients, because we don't want anything to blow up and not work.
So I agree useful Swagger is critical. Would you propose having multiple versions of the Swagger for the different API versions? We've done that in the past with products and it's been useful.
Yeah, so part of this is making sure that we get all the Swagger into a centralized repository so you can do a diff on it. So if you're looking for an older version of the Swagger, then at least you're able to obtain that, right? So these would all be version controlled and source controlled, all the Swagger files.
But is it a diff, or can I just have access to, I know I'm using 2.1, therefore give me the 2.1 version of the Swagger.
Yeah, and if we have that centralized repository, you'll be able to access that older version. It's not like it just overwrites it. So you could actually go back to a previous version and not have to do a diff, but if you wanted to. But yeah, absolutely. They should stay in the repository.
And on a related note, I think in some cases the Swagger is all on one page, which takes a very long time to load. So adding versioning might be a good opportunity to go back and rethink the organization of the Swagger.
Yes, and that's something that Greg Glover is working actively on right now, specific to ONAP. So like I said, some of the things that I was working on internally for AT&T had a touch point and an intersection with his effort. So we're kind of combining that. And I think by next week, he'll have like the combined, you know, API versioning / documentation.
So are you familiar with the proposal that's currently out there on Confluence for the APIs that we expose?
I did see two, one for the API versioning that wasn't flushed out, and I think there's an API kind of policy, right? And I think that's the one you're referring to, right? Not the one that says we need to think about this, this, and this, but the one that's more documented out, like, you know, these are kind of the API requirements, right?
Well, I mean, there's a proposal. I mean, so to me, this is good. I think what's missing here maybe is a notion of a taxonomy as well for APIs. Some of these are going to be public, exposed by ONAP externally. Some of these are going to be ONAP private, used within ONAP. Some of these are going to be specific to a project, and we need to classify them accordingly, whether they're public or private and what their scope is. And then the notion of backward compatibility obviously gets linked to what is allowed in what version in terms of deprecation of APIs or addition of new ones.
So,
but I think before we get there, we should probably decide on what style of API we're going to use and to what extent it's truly restful as opposed to REST-like.
What are the implications of public versus private APIs?
So public APIs are the ones that you would be concerned with the most in terms of versioning, because they would impact interoperability. Maybe interoperability between projects or interoperability between ONAP and other software. Project private APIs that are not exposed to anybody, well, then, you know, if you use them for some reason, that's your own fault.
Right.
But
In my experience, though, that the APIs that people think are private can turn out to be the thing that saves your butt in the field when you're trying to
Again, it's I'm not saying it doesn't save your butt in the field. I'm just saying that you need to set expectations correctly. Because what also happens in the field, people start using private APIs, and then, well, before we even talk about a field, this is an open source project, so there is no field. But let's just say it is a productized release. You would you quite often will end up using private APIs in the field to fix something, and then it becomes a public API, right, whether you want it or not. That's a mistake.
Is it though? Because why would we not just hold the private APIs to the same standard? Since to accept the reality that in practice, they get used, they solve a problem, they're useful.
Well, because that's how you break the architecture of something in a really bad way.
Break okay? or evolve it?
And for no, well, evolve it means that you propose something in the community, and then it gets evolved. If you just randomly use some API during the integration of some solution and then insist that from this point on it's a public API, you've completely gone around the consensus process within the community and so on. So this is, again, not a commercial product. This is an open source community.
Okay, fair enough. Most of what I'm talking about is from commercial products.
Commercial products are completely different. I agree with you. You can take chances there and then either get punished for them or rewarded. It really depends. But this is an open source community.
This is Steve. Just a couple of things. First, I think this is really good. I think we need something like this. And I think we need to actually, I think it's good to socialize it through here. And Chris, I think we need to bring this up to the TSC for, because I think it's also a TSC decision there.
Yes.
Secondly, as well, I guess there will be cases when we, and from a scoping perspective, there'll be cases when we use, you know, adopt APIs from somewhere where we may have to allow exceptions to this. But I think for ONAP, homegrown APIs, something like this, maybe when we socialize for feedback, there's some points to discuss and so on, but something like this I think is really good.
I just think we need to combine it with the whole model-driven approach and also pick a style of a REST API that we're going to use first. I think Parviz posted something on the chat, and I posted something on the chat. Have a look and see, right? I mean, there are different styles of REST APIs and different notions of how much you want to expose at the API, at the URI header, right? Or from the URI perspective.
Understood, but Alex, I think one thing is, I mean, if we try to get everything agreed at the one time, it can be kind of difficult sometimes. The statements down is sometimes good.
Just simply saying we need to consider all this as we do this. This is an excellent idea. It's long overdue, actually. So.
Steve, this is Parviz. You said that this is a TSC decision. What problem you're going to pose to TSC? What is the problem?
The policy of do we adopt an API versioning would go to the TSC. Once we have the proposal solidified inside the architecture team, but in order to have the full weight for deployment starting in Casablanca, we need the TSC to approve it.
For API version, hold on. For API versioning, as Alex said, the link that I posted, it talks about three as part of the guideline, three major points. I don't know that today's presentation probably is way beyond the scope of those 3 points, okay? So that's one thing. The other thing Alex mentioned, RESTful versus REST-like, that is a part of our suggestion for Casablanca, but we need to have a deep dive discussion on that. And Alex, you have the pen, yeah? You want to bring something that the gap between RESTful versus REST-like, do you have some idea on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I see a lot of APIs where essentially using REST interactions with the, you know, the HTTP requests as a way of doing RPC. Okay. And that's not the same thing as true REST. And so we need to be very careful here, because what we don't want to do is, you know, kid ourselves and say we're doing some resource-oriented APIs, and instead what we're doing is good old protocols, but just using HTTP POST instead of something else. That's not the idea, right? And so we need to follow REST rules, in my opinion. And then when we follow those rules, then we can figure out what we need to version in accordance with those rules. I'm not disagreeing or saying that versioning is not important. It's very important. But, you know, let's align it with the objectives of the APIs and the architectural approach that we would like to use, I think, first. And then we can put, you know, we can decide, you know, when to do the versioning.
Can't we just solve them both in parallel? They're sort of orthogonal, except that if you're going to break the backwards compatibility of our APIs by fixing them, having versioning is helpful.
Well, so, you know, again, you know, have a look at what Parviz posted. You know, this talks about versioning just the API URLs, right? But at the same time, you know, what about the headers? What about the envelope information? What about other things? Do we expose the versions of those, even though the actual API invocation hasn't changed? I mean, there are lots of things we need to kind of look at. There's also more specific, you know, harder or more... you know, the dialects of REST that you can use that also imply certain version handling. So I guess we kind of need to pick what we, you know, I agree in general, good idea, but, you know, let's not put the cart before the horse. Let's define the APIs and what they're going to be like, and then we can figure out how to version them properly.
So what I'm hearing is three people who are interested. Alex and Parviz, can you work with Dana on updating the proposal?
Sure, but I think Wabing was the one who proposed the APIs, you know, give credit where credit is due. And the APIs he proposed are very much tied to how we're using the microservice bus. And so it's not a random thing we do. It's all related. So we need to make sure that what we do with the microservices and how we're going to use the API externally and internally aligns with all this. So yeah, we can help craft this. I just want to make sure that we don't break something that we already have.
So what I'm hearing then is the four of you will go off and work this and come back.
I do have a comment. So, Alex, you're very passionate about it, and I welcome that, and I agree. But if you read Roy Fielding's position on what a RESTful API really is, you get very upset that people ignore the value of, you know, headers and all that stuff and focus on using, as you say, RPC. But the key point he brings, and this is, I'm going to bring it just because I know you're also very passionate about it. He says you should spend 90% of your time doing media type modeling, which for us into a model-driven approach. So if you guys
look, and that's what we need to do. We definitely want to go that way, but at least in my opinion, but again, we need time to consider it. You know, let's not ready, fire, aim. Let's actually do this in sequence.
Right, but don't lose sight of the fact that that's what we want to tie it to the model-driven.
No, peace, Adolfo. I think I agree with you. And I just want to say, I'm not sure what field we're talking about, right? You know, we have people taking snapshots of ONAP and deploying it, right? We have operators doing that. But, you know, we've yet to come up with any notion. I'm not sure what field applies to here and why we need to...
Well, what I mean by when people are using it and they're using it in production.
Well, okay. So this is one more reason to get a taxonomy in place and say that not only when something is public or private, whether or not something is volatile, evolving, stable, and deprecated.
Right, which fits somewhat with versioning.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. But again, I agree, we need to have those classifications. But I think the problem you're talking about is just basically setting expectations on what can and cannot be used in the field.
Well, yeah, certainly setting expectations is a good start.
Sure. You can't stop them. So maybe what we need to do is, as we embark on Casablanca design, Chris, architecture rather, and as we start talking about maybe a more model-driven approach, at least externally to begin with, we need to kind of congeal all this and make sure that what Bing is doing is not going to get jeopardized by this as well, right? You know, we kind of need to align it.
Sure. So what I'd like to suggest then is that the four of you go off and explore this in more detail and then come back, and I will schedule a follow-up whenever you're ready.
Okay.
Okay, hold on, Chris. Dana is leading this, yeah? Or someone else?
Yes. Dana, if that's okay with you, if you want to lead the activity, and then Parviz, Alex, and Wabing will work with you.
Sure. I have my email address up in the deck. I was asked to post it in a PDF, so I'm going to put it up in a PDF. If you could just send me an email so I have your contact information, and we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, I'll do that.
There's a, just want to say that there's a sequence of events here, right? We don't want this to be some random act of architecture. I think there's some other decisions that we have to tee up before this one. So Adolfo mentioned model driven. Let's agree on what that actually means. It means a lot of different things to different people. And you know, for the modularity discussion we're talking about, we need to understand what model driven really implies. It doesn't just mean we have a Tosca template for something. That's something that I think needs to happen before we start considering, you know, API styles or whether or not we use patch or post. Let's do this, you know, the right way.
And you're on the calendar for next week for just that, Alex.
If it helps, Alex, I can engage in discussion.
Oh, you know, I think that would be wonderful.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, Chris?
Yes.
I guess what Alex is putting more colors to what you asked for. So we need to go back to that Venn diagram and then make a good sense of those labels, yeah, in the partial circles and the cross-section of those three circles, and bring clarification and more explanation for each, yeah?
Right.
That is okay.
Yep.
So Alex, who is taking the ownership? Maybe I'll try to tackle the model-driven aspect.
Alex has that presentation next week.
Oh, Alex, you have it? Okay.
I do. I thought we were talking about the approach to model design.
Sorry, I made a mistake. I remember you and Andy were up.
We were going to talk about how to build models going forward.
Okay.
Which is a little bit different.
Yeah. So that's taken. Then we have the 5G and enabling 5G. That's Vimal or somebody else.
I think to be honest, that diagram and that, I think Mazen said he would actually try to put something together based on the initial inputs. Is that right, Chris?
He was going to get the end user advisory group together, but architecture and use case were supposed to take that initial diagram and go to the next level of detail. So
okay,
we have a role, and Allah's committee has a role.
Okay, great.
Only thing, Chris, is that we can go ahead and do, but I think that we'll have a huge impact on based on what advisory board says, what user community is looking for, the service providers are looking for.
Right.
Well, the, my sense is,
That's going to take a little while to get up and running. We definitely want to collect that input as soon as it's available to us. But I don't want to wait in the meantime, because I think there's some stuff that we can all agree to is going to be important. And we should focus on that and then use the user advisory group as it comes in to shape what we're doing and shape the final deliverables.
Well, to me, it's just one of the inputs. I personally don't see how the knock or whatever we call it is going to decide on some of the more technical issues. I think,
yep.
I guess the way I read it, you know, is it going to be more of an operator perspective than architectural perspective.
So Chris, Alex and Andy are going to take care of the model-driven aspects. There is the 5G enabling piece. I don't know, Vimal and the team, they're already working on this, correct? Then we have the microservices aspects in the Tiger team. We already started some discussion.
Mm-hmm.
We try to finalize the discussion and probably I put some slides together for the ARC future meeting, yeah? So that is the microservices bit, huh?
That's great. And I know there are a number of people on this call who are passionate about topics who've already been talking to me about scheduling some. There's some JIRA tickets. Yeah. If there isn't a name associated and you want to take one, let me know and I'll put your name on it and we can get you scheduled. So we'll continue to work these through. Next week's call is the agenda is pretty well finalized. There might be a small slot. And then we still have some time the week after, and we'll keep scheduling that out for the next month or so. Okay.
Chris, just a clarification. On S3P, do we have any remaining issue? Or that's work in progress?
We're going to have to come up with the levels for Casablanca. So that's something we have to discuss in the framework that we have. You know, it fits into something else that is going to be in every release because, you know, it's just a continuous focus. We'll just have to figure out what the correct levels are.
So one suggestion, Chris, could be we take what we did for Jason's presentation for Beijing.
Yep.
And let's say that one criteria was that we want to have 50% coverage. Well, maybe Casablanca, we set the target to be 60% coverage. If we set the target to be level one for something, then we say, is it possible to go to level two for that criteria? Or that?
I agree with this, because that was set up as a multi-release.
Yes.
Matrix. So I mean, and also if we start flip flopping too much on each release, we will drive this nowhere. So we need to have consistency in pushing this forward. So I think that's the right approach.
Yeah, that's the plan. But at the same time, we're going to take the feedback from the PTLs from the last release from Beijing, and see if there are any tweaks that we have to make.
So Chris, one thought here is that. Rather than chasing this S3P thing, or maybe in addition to chasing it, talking about some of the architectural patterns that give you the equivalent of 5 nines by using multiple copies of a service with a redundant mesh in front might be something we want to consider as well.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like for some of the the traditional notion of S3P would be hard to attain for things that run inside containers and VMs. But multiple copies certainly solve some of that.
Okay. Why don't we schedule that? And I think also bring in the OOM team, because I think they're already making strides in that direction.
Yep.
And also, I think we have some upcoming presentation, the service mesh, right? I think that will address several of these concerns. I mean, S3P concerns very well.
I agree. Yeah.
Tell me when you're ready on that.
Yes. Sorry, Chris. I've just been terribly busy. I think next couple of weeks I will work closely also with the OM team. I think there's, I mean, several folks very interested in this topic and definitely have something out there.
Yeah, and OP and FE wanted to talk about that as well. So when you're ready, let's schedule this. There's a Clover project working in OP&FE, and some of the people on that thought that that may be applicable to ONAP. So we'll have that discussion coming up.
Correct. Makes sense.
Hey, Ramki, please add me to the contributor list. I have some ideas. Okay.
Sure. Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Anything else for today? We finished up a little bit ahead of schedule. Okay. Well, I'll break a little early then and give everybody back an extra 20 minutes in your day. Thank you very much. This was a good discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.